Welcome to this special spin-off audio program to a CME satellite symposium held during the annual ASCO meeting in Chicago in June. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this meeting, we asked three oncologists in community-based practice to present cases via video recording to the faculty of six clinical investigators to discuss. After the meeting, I met with two of the faculty, Dr. Robert Orlowski, to discuss the myeloma cases, and Dr. Brad Call to comment on the lymphoma cases. To begin, I asked Dr. Orlowski about a patient presented by Dr. Eric Rupard from Reading, Pennsylvania.
A 76-year-old woman who presented with multiple compression fractures, found to have IgA kappa light chain myeloma. She actually entered the ECOG trial, E1AE11, randomizing between RVD and KRD. And she actually was randomized to KRD. It turned out, if you remember, she had a very rapid and profound response after three cycles. The numbers had dropped, just plummeted. And actually, the doctor, Dr. Rupard, who presented the case, was saying that he had never seen this kind of response. I don't think he's really used KRD up front very much. So first, I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you generally think through upfront therapy in an older person like this, a 76-year-old, as opposed to a younger patient, and how data that's been presented recently, particularly relating to 3-versus-2 drugs as well as transplant, fits into the way you're approaching patients.
Yeah, definitely a great question. I would say that the most important recent data set that was presented around this was from the SWOG study, where patients were randomized who had newly diagnosed myeloma that was symptomatic to receive either lenalidomide and dexamethasone or bortezomib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And these were patients either who were not transplant candidates or did not intend to do stem cell transplant as their initial therapy. And the study showed that with the addition of bortezomib, there was an improved progression-free survival as well as an improved overall survival. And I think that really gives us the first major phase 3 data impetus to show that the VRD regimen is something that is superior to RD. And I think in a robust patient, even a 76-year-old, generally a 3-drug regimen would be preferred compared to a 2-drug. And I would say, by the way, that a 76-year-old could be a transplant candidate. Here, at least at MD Anderson, we do not look at chronologic age, we look at physiologic age, and we've even transplanted patients. I think the oldest I've sent to transplant was 79 years old, and she did quite well and is still doing fine.
So in terms of the 3-versus-2 question, we polled the audience, and by far the most common upfront therapy they use in younger patients is RVD. But we also asked them about a 76-year-old patient like this patient, and still, the most common answer was RVD or RVD light. And I wanted to ask you how you modify, if at all, RVD in older patients.
Yeah, definitely. You referred to RVD light, and there are a couple of differences between that and the so-called classical RVD. The main difference is that the bortezomib is given once per week for 3 weeks on and 1 week off on a 4-week schedule, whereas the original RVD that Paul Richardson published was a 3-week schedule, and the bortezomib was given twice weekly in the first and second weeks. Also, RVD light has a slightly lower dose of lenalidomide, in part because of the rationale that typically more mature patients have a lower creatinine clearance, and therefore you typically have to adjust the dose of the lenalidomide anyway.
So you obviously are very oriented towards transplant and even thinking about it in elderly patients. Can you talk a little bit about the data that was presented on the question of transplant versus not at ASH, you know, sort of one half of the dual trial, the French part, the IFM part, and the North American part? Of course, we don't have data on yet, but can you talk about those data and what you think about it?
The study was designed in a manner that all patients received RVD induction therapy, And there was a randomization so that after stem cell collection, some patients went on to early stem cell transplant and then maintenance afterwards. Whereas in the other group, stem cells were collected and stored, but they underwent additional cycles of RVD and not transplant. And then also they went on to maintenance therapy. And the intent really was that when patients did progress on the arm that had not received transplant up front, that they would receive it as part of their second line therapy. And what the data from the IFM portion of the study showed is that progression-free survival was longer if you got the transplant up front, but the difference was actually only about 9 months, so not a huge difference. And if you looked at overall survival at 4 years, it was identical in the two arms. You could interpret that, therefore, in two different ways. If you are somebody who likes to do transplant very early, you can interpret that and say that you have a longer progression-free survival with the early transplant. If you're someone who favors a delayed transplant approach, then the rationale from those data would be that you could delay a transplant until second line. And because overall survival was not different, you don't really compromise the patient's outcome. I personally feel that the way we will probably do things in the future will be more directed by the molecular genetics and minimal residual disease of the patient. And what I mean is, if you have a newly diagnosed patient who is good risk and achieves a complete remission and is MRD negative, usually by flow cytometry of the bone marrow or by sequencing, probably in that sort of patient, if they want to delay a transplant until first relapse, it would be very reasonable. But if you have a good risk patient who for some reason does not achieve a complete remission and MRD negativity, then I would suggest to go ahead and transplant them. And I think for high-risk patients where we still don't know exactly what the best therapy is, there are some studies that suggest transplant is of benefit and others that maybe it could be less so. But I would still probably suggest to transplant those patients earlier rather than later, especially if they don't achieve MRD negativity. But I should emphasize that this is still a hypothesis, and we need to, of course, prove that this kind of algorithm is effective.
Well, I don't know about the statistical rules of the trial, but it did look like the patients who became MRD negative from the induction with RVD, they seem to do as well as the people who got transplanted.
Well, you're right. And of course, there were a number of different MRD studies that were done. The flow cytometry was done. There was MRI. There was PET scan. And in general, what they show is that, of course, people who are MRD negative do better than those who are MRD positive, which isn't a shocker considering that less cancer is always going to be better than more cancer. But ideally, what we would need is a randomized study to look at that. And this study did not randomize based on MRD status, which is what I would propose to do.
So I guess another issue is the North American version of this trial. And one of the points I've heard people make and say, I want to see those data, is that there they used indefinite len maintenance. So maybe the control arm is going to get bumped up enough that you really won't even see a difference.
Yeah, that's a good point. The French did maintenance with lenalidomide for 2 years. On the US side, it's going to be until progression. And the other study that will, I think, help inform the maintenance question will be, you mentioned earlier, the study comparing KRD to VRD in the upfront setting. There's a second randomization in that study, which is to len maintenance for 2 years versus len maintenance indefinitely. And I think those will help very much in deciding how long to give len for. One benefit of KRD may be that because K has less neuropathy associated with it than V, It may be that patients can stay on a carfilzomib regimen for longer, and we know that if you stay on effective therapy for a longer period, you're going to have a better outcome. The only caveat is that for patients who are 75 or older, the high-dose carfilzomib may be associated with a higher risk of cardiac effects.
And I was going to bring that up, too, because we didn't show the video of this at the meeting itself, but, you know, I interviewed not only the doctors, but also the patients. And when I asked Dr. Rupart, how did the patient tolerate the KRD, he said, no problem. I specifically said, did she have any dyspnea? He said, no. And then when I interviewed the patient, I asked, well, how was treatment? And the first thing she said was, oh, yeah, it was fine, except every time I got it, I had trouble breathing for 12 to 24 hours. And she described to me, it was interesting, it was kind of a heaviness that she felt in her chest. And it didn't get worse on exercise, at least that's what she said. And I'm curious what your experience is, what patients tell you, and kind of what you think's going on in a patient like this. In her case, she cruised right through the treatment and never even mentioned it to her doctor, actually.
Well, I think it was a very wise move that you made by talking to both the patient and the doctor separately, because I think it's a lesson to all of us that we need probably to ask more questions of our patients when they're coming back for toxicity assessments. Although, in fairness, sometimes patients are not as comfortable talking about side effects to their doctors as opposed to the nurse, for example. But in terms of the dyspnea or shortness of breath, it is a side effect that is associated with carfilzomib. We don't really understand the mechanism very well, but I've seen it not just in older patients like the one you described in this case, but I've seen it even in younger patients who don't have any prior cardiac history. One of the things that's important to do is to make sure that we don't overhydrate these patients. At the beginning of the carfilzomib development, there was discussion about possible tumor lysis, and so there was institution of pre- and post-hydration. And although that helped in some ways, I think it may contribute to this dyspnea, and especially in older patients who may be a little bit smaller in terms of their BSA, their creatinine clearance may be a little bit lower. If you're talking about both pre- and post-hydration after each dose of the carfilzomib, that could be quite a bit of fluid. So we usually don't do the post-hydration, quite frankly, and often we will do the pre-hydration only for the first two doses, because if the tumor lysis really is going to occur, it's going to occur early rather than later. The other thing to mention, of course, is that we did have last year ixazomib approved, which is an oral proteasome inhibitor similar to bortezomib in the chemistry department. And there also is a carfilzomib-like oral proteasome inhibitor, which is in development called aprozomib. And it may be that in the future, we will either switch to totally oral therapy, or there may be, again, some period during which we give either IV carfilzomib or subcutaneous bortezomib for sort of an initial induction, if you will, for a cycle or two, and then switch to the oral versions of those drugs.
You mentioned aprozomib, the oral agent similar to carfilzomib. Last I heard, that was still being tested. I was hearing things about problems with toxicity. Has it moved along any further since that point?
Well, both of the oral proteasome inhibitors, ixazomib as well as aprozomib, had some increased gastrointestinal effects, which certainly is logical considering that you're taking it as a pill. And with the previous formulation of aprozomib, there did seem to be perhaps a higher GI signal than people were comfortable with. So it's now been reformulated and is going to be back in the clinic and hopefully will show similar efficacy as did ixazomib. And the other exciting thing about ixazomib was that if you look at the phase 3 trial, the relative added toxicity of this third drug on top of len and dex was almost negligible. So hopefully the same will be true with aprozomib.
So let's go on to the next patient. And actually, this patient received ixazomib, and we'll talk about that in a second. And she's 73 years old. And it was interesting, you know, we had three oncologists giving us cases that we chose for this meeting. And we saw several cases like this, and it kind of wasn't really on my radar. And there were a lot of questions about patients who get delayed transplant. So this lady was 73 when she got transplanted, but she actually had received multiple therapies prior to that because she wasn't going to be transplanted, and she changed her mind. She had gotten lenalidomide, pomalidomide, carfilzomib, bortezomib, everything, all those agents, and then got transplanted. And the question was, what about maintenance in this kind of a situation? First of all, we asked the audience, in general, in this kind of situation, do you use some type of maintenance? And the majority of the audience, three quarters, said yes. And then the question is, what kind of maintenance? Now, this patient, the transplanter, had actually recommended exazimib, which is what the patient went on. And Dr. Lowell Hart, whose patient it was, went along with it. He never used exazimib before, and the patient's doing fine. But he wanted to know about this issue, first of all, of maintenance after a delayed transplant. And then the second thing being, what about exazimib as maintenance?
Yeah, those are all great questions. First, in terms of the timing of transplant, we talked a little bit about that earlier. Certainly, if the patient decides up front they don't want, and then a couple of years into it, they decide that they do, that's a different scenario. But I would not advocate for delaying a transplant past the first relapse, because the benefit of the transplant is then going to be typically a little bit less if they've had 3 to 4 prior lines of therapy. In terms of maintenance, most of the large phase 3 studies in the post-transplant setting took patients who had gotten their first transplant within about 12 months of their diagnosis. So we don't have as much data about patients like this who may have waited a couple of years. But I don't see a reason why the data would have been different had they accepted these types of patients. The one thing I would suggest, though, is that because of the number of prior lines of therapy, it may be that a combination maintenance approach would be better. And what we've done here, based in part on a pilot study that Jatin Shah led, is we've used the combination of lenalidomide with exazimib as a maintenance. And I would probably have recommended that for this patient. In terms of exazimib as a single agent, there has been a study that was done for post-transplant patients comparing placebo to exazimib, but the data for that trial have not yet been announced. But I would suspect, of course, that exazimib will certainly be better in terms of progression-free survival and probably overall survival than would just placebo.
And that, you know, sort of gets into the issue also about the use of proteasome inhibitors as part of maintenance therapy after transplant. I've been hearing more and more investigators talk about mainly using bortezomib in patients who are high risk, for example, 17P. Some people have used RVD maintenance. What are your thoughts about proteasome inhibitors as post-transplant maintenance?
Well, we have a couple of data sets that show that proteasome inhibitor maintenance is effective, especially for high-risk patients. The biggest data set comes from the Dutch and German study, where they did VAD transplant and thalidomide maintenance in one arm, and in the second arm, they did bortezomib with doxorubicin and dex as induction transplant, and then bortezomib maintenance. And actually, the biggest benefit was for the group that had deletion 17P for the bortezomib arm. Also, Sagarlonial at Emory published some nice data with the VRD combination as a maintenance and showed that it was effective in high risk, although that was not a randomized study. My tendency is to go just with the IMID and the proteasome inhibitor and drop out the steroids. The rationale for that is that in the past, when steroids alone were used as maintenance, they were shown to improve progression-free but not overall survival. And of course, they come with quite a bit of toxicity. That doesn't mean that in a combination, they may not add to overall survival. But in general, we've done, again, the len and ixazomib approach. I think bortezomib is certainly very reasonable as well. The only downside is, of course, it has to be given as an injection, but you can give it according to the schedule that the Dutch and German trial used, which was essentially one sub-Q injection every 2 weeks. If you go with ixazomib, it's one capsule for 1 week, 2 week, and 3 week, and then you have an off week in the 4th week, and then you go back to the 1st week in cycle 2.
What are some of the typical clinical situations right now where you're using ixazomib and with what?
Well, one of the major ones is one we've discussed already, which is maintenance therapy in patients who maybe are at higher risk from their first transplant or maybe have had a second transplant, and we use ixazomib with lenalidomide. Also, for patients who have travel challenges, let's say either in the newly diagnosed setting or in the relapsed or refractory setting, then starting with ixazomib, len, and dex is certainly very reasonable because you can get away with essentially one visit to the office per month. And that's because you need to do the lenalidomide prescription every 28 days. The ixazomib can actually be given with a refill. So those are the two major scenarios where we've used it at MD Anderson up to now. I can say I've also used ixazomib in the relapsed setting in other combinations. I've used it with cyclophosphamide-based therapies. I've used it with just dexamethasone. And I think the efficacy has been really quite good and the tolerability has been excellent. So like bortezomib and like carfilzomib, I think you can really add ixazomib to whatever is your favorite combination.
So we'll talk in a minute about daratumumab, including the data that was presented at ASCO. But just to finish out on ixazomib, what about ixazomib / daratumumab?
Yeah, great question. And I think you referred to the plenary session at ASCO where there were data presented comparing bortezomib and dex to daratumumab, bortezomib, and dex. And I think if you had asked people in the field before the study data were shown whether it would be a positive study, we would have all said, oh, yes, it will be. But the exciting thing is that the magnitude of the difference was really dramatic. Hazard ratio of about 0.4, which is incredibly low, meaning an incredible benefit to the addition of daratumumab. And although we don't have large data sets with ixa and dara yet in combination, I would see absolutely no reason why I would not go ahead and use that combination.
So when I talked to this patient, it was also very interesting. She did, as you were referring to, describe to me some GI toxicity that she had, upper nausea kind of feeling, and the dose was adjusted down. I think she went from 5 to 4 milligrams, and now she has no problem whatsoever. Is that typically what you see in terms of dose, you know, relationship?
You can reduce the dose, although the experience has been that the GI upset that can sometimes come with ixazomib typically is only with the first dose. And usually with the second dose, people are either completely fine or substantially better. So for me, unless they have really severe GI toxicity with the first dose, I actually don't reduce it with the second dose, because typically they'll get better on their own. And the standard starting dose, by the way, is 4 milligram. So the first dose reduction would be to 3 milligram.
So let's go on and talk about the next case. This is also a patient of Dr. Hart's, 73-year-old man, status post multiple therapies. Bottom line is he was about to start the patient on daratumumab. And there were a bunch of questions that he had about that. And the first one relates to the infusion reactions that have been seen with this drug. And he brought up something I had never heard before, and he was concerned about not being able to get the infusion done on time. We actually asked the audience, how long is your infusion room open? And it varied from 6 to 12 hours or more than 12 hours. But he actually had heard about, and he decided, because it made sense to him, to split the dose into two. And in fact, the first dose that was given on the first day that had to be given very, very slowly over many hours. And he was able to get the full dose in over 2 days. But he was really wanted to know from the faculty, is that a rational strategy? Is that something you would ever do? And also, I'd be curious to know what your experience is with infusion reactions and how long it takes to get the drug in.
Well, fortunately, at MD Anderson, we have infusion areas that are open virtually 24 hours a day. And so we have no problem getting the daratumumab in one sitting. But infusion reactions are definitely an issue with whether it be daratumumab or also to some extent elotuzumab. And they can be anything from mild to more significant. And they happen in about 30 to 50% of patients. And what you typically then have to do is, of course, stop the infusion, add additional pre-medications, wait until the reaction resolves, restart at a slower rate, and try to go back up. So you mentioned that infusion centers can be open locally 6 to 12 hours. Certainly with 12 hours, you should be able to get most patients treated with either Dara or Elo. But 6 hours could be a little bit challenging in some. We have not ourselves looked at splitting the dose into 2 days, but I really cannot see a reason why that would not be a very viable approach. It should be just as effective. The half-life of these antibodies is usually around 14 to 17 days. So the dose that you give on day one is still going to be present even if you give the second half of the dose on day two. I would certainly love to see some data about that approach, but right now I would have no concern about it. And I would say if that's what you have to do to get the Dara in, then go ahead and do it.
Well, that's good that you said that, because when we asked the audience whether they thought it was acceptable, 25% said yes, 25% said no, and 50% said they didn't know. So at least they've got some input on that question. Another thing that Dr. Hart brought up about the daratumumab relates to cross-matching with blood and the fact that it's known to cause a positive indirect antiglobulin test, the Coombs test. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what goes on there and from a practical standpoint, what you do about it?
Yeah, so CD38, which is the target for daratumumab, is of course present on the myeloma cells, but also is present on red blood cells. And when you infuse the drug, some of the daratumumab does bind to red blood cells, and that's why you can get this positive test. Usually all you need to do is let your blood bank or local center know that your patient is on Dara, and then there's a neat trick that they can play, which is to treat the blood from the patient which is being typed with a reagent called DTT or dithiothreatol. And if you remember back to the biology days when we were in medical school, you'll remember that there are disulfide bonds which hold the heavy chains and the light chains together in the antibody. And what DTT does is it breaks up those bonds, essentially denatures the antibody, and then it's possible to normally type the red blood cells.
Where do you see things heading in the future with daratumumab? As you mentioned, this plenary talk really had people talking about this. People have talked about for a long time the concept is there going to be an R-CHOP kind of thing in myeloma? Are we just going to be heading down the road of like rituximab in lymphoma, where you just sort of give it regardless of what you're giving it with and in almost every situation? Do you think that's where we're heading?
I do. And you mentioned the ASCO data, but about a few days after that, there were data presented at the European Hematology Association meeting that were from a phase 3 study of Dara-Lendex versus Lendex, where again, the hazard ratio was a little bit even better than 0.4, showing a huge benefit for the Dara-containing combo. So it does look like daratumumab is going to be the rituximab for myeloma that you'll be able to add to probably any combination regimen. And with the exception of maybe the infusion reactions and maybe a slight increase in cytopenias, the relative added toxicity is going to be mild, but the efficacy advantage is going to be quite large. I would say the one thing we don't know yet is whether treatment with daratumumab several times will be of benefit. And what I mean is, let's say you do Daralendex and you progress on that and you decide that you want to use bortezomib or ixazomib. Is it enough to give bortezdex or ixadex, or should you give Dara again with the bortezdex or the ixadex? And we don't know that yet for sure, although there are a couple of case reports already that suggest that you can effectively treat with Dara in the same patient at two different points in their disease.
So the last case that we talked about that I want to bring back up to you was from Dr. Frances Valdez, a younger woman, 53, who'd had transplant, the usual sort of route, RVD up front, and then relapsed on len maintenance. Now, she actually treated the patient with carfilzomib, pom, and dex, and I think it was before elotuzumab was approved, but in reflecting back on the case, she was really bringing up the issue of the patient who relapses on len maintenance, which is certainly is a common situation. And one strategy about increasing the dose of the len and adding elotuzumab in. What do you think about that strategy? And right now, what do we know about elotuzumab and how do you use it?
Yeah, great question. Elo is, as you know, another antibody with a slightly different target than Dara. It binds a protein called SLAMF7. Which is present on myeloma cells, and interestingly also present on NK or natural killer cells. But because the intracellular signaling is different, when ELO binds myeloma cells, it promotes cell death, whereas when it binds NK cells, it actually activates them and makes them angrier and helps in the fight against myeloma. When you have a patient who's progressing on len maintenance, one of the important things is to understand the clinical progress, if you will. And what I mean by that is that if the M protein is going up really slowly and the patient is asymptomatic, it may be enough to either even just watch and wait or do something relatively modest, like up the lenalidomide dose a little bit, or maybe add some low-dose dexamethasone, and oftentimes those patients will have their M protein start to come down. However, if the patient has a more aggressive course where either they're clinically symptomatic, they're getting anemic, they've got new bone lesions, or they're hypercalcemic, then those are patients who I would treat more aggressively. Also, even if they're not symptomatic, but their M protein is really going up rapidly, you know, let's say that it doubles every couple months or the free light chain ratio is really going up, those are people I would probably treat with a 3-drug regimen. And I think that certainly going with full dose len and adding ELO at that point is reasonable. Although my preference, frankly, for a very symptomatic patient would be to add as many new drugs as possible. So I like the notion of giving carpom-dex to this patient rather than just keeping the len and adding ELO as just one new drug. I think if you go with more new drugs, you're going to probably have a better outcome. You could consider switching to POM with ELO and DEX in this kind of patient. I think that would be my preference as opposed to just LEN with ELO and DEX if they were symptomatic.
What's a typical clinical scenario where you do use ELO LEN?
Well, of course, it's approved for patients with 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy, and it does work quite well in combination with lenalidomide. So somebody who, for example, has just progressed on a proteasome inhibitor-containing combination without lenalidomide, I think would be a very good candidate. Somebody who perhaps is not on maintenance post-transplant, I think would be a very good candidate. So those are some of the options there.